Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, on the Heritage Radio Network. And just wanted to remind our listeners that heritageradionetwork.org is a member-supported network. So please click into our website and look at all the programming and perhaps make a donation. We would really appreciate it. You know, if you are listening in real time, or if you're listening within this next week or so of the podcast, you can listen anytime you want, fine with me. But we are winding down summer, and the air is full of the smell of clean notebooks and crisp binders and sharpened number two pencils all lined up in their cases, for a little while at least. Indeed, it's back to school time, and I thought it would be appropriate to present a program that was, not that my programs aren't all academic, but perhaps a little more academic, and we'll start the season off with a textbook. The author of the textbook and my guest is Ken Albala, and Ken is a food historian and professor of history at the University of the Pacific in Stockton, California. He is the author and or editor of, I don't even want to count how many books, over 20 books at this point. Everything from Eating Right in the Renaissance to The Lost Art of Real Cooking. His most recent book is The Food History Reader, Primary Sources. And, you know, on this show, I think the comments that I receive most after my shows are from listeners who say, gee, you know, you mentioned some text or some old book or something you used for a resource. Could you give me the name of that book? And often I can't remember. I'll have to listen again. But I think that that is something of interest to anyone who involves themselves in food history or culinary history. And to my great pleasure, and I hope to many of our listeners, the Food History Reader really is like a primer for anyone interested in food history. And Ken also has a 36-episode course. It's available on DVD, which I think is fabulous, and that's on a cultural culinary history. He also is the director of the new Food Studies graduate program at the Pacific's San Francisco campus. Ken has a blog, the Ken Albala Food Rant, and he's given TEDx talks. I'm so glad you've taken the time to be with me today, Ken. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
So tell me a little bit. I know that you must run into the same thing that I do just giving these talks, but as an instructor and professor, people asking you, well, what do I read? How do I become a food historian? What do I study? Tell me a little bit about why you chose to do this book.
Well, this book has actually been many years in the making. Oddly enough, when I first started teaching food history, which has got to be about 15 years ago, I did a small seminar and thought we need to read the primary sources. And so I collected as many as I could and, back in those days, Xeroxed them off for my whole class. And I thought back then that it would make a great book and as an anthology of food history sources, and tried to shop it around. And as you probably know, food history was not quite where it is today. It was not illegitimate, but it didn't quite have the status in academia as it does now, and certainly not when I started 20 years ago. And I really couldn't sell it. I mean, I sent proposals to, I don't know, maybe a dozen different publishers, and they all said, who's going to buy this? How many food history courses can there be in the world, you know, that we need a reader like this? And so I put it in the shelf and basically forgot about it and began teaching the same food history course as a large lecture basically for, general education credit. And similar food history courses started popping up here and there. And eventually I thought, I really need a reader for this class. I also teach at Boston in their graduate program. And I thought for an MA program, we definitely need to be reading the primary sources. And I think the whole field kind of ripened. And there now is a market for it. It's doing very well. It's not exactly the same reader I started with. It's a lot more global in scope now, so there's sections on China and India and places like that. But I think the food history kind of matured and is ripe for a good reader now.
Well, indeed, the food history indeed has matured. And this book, I have to say, you're right, it does. It spans the globe. But not only does it span the globe, it spans time period from classic antiquity to all the way to the present. And it illustrates, I think of it more as culinary history. That's that great divide. I know we should erase that line between culinary history and food history, but it really illustrates the ways that social structure, religion, politics, health, everything played into what people ate and how they thought about food and how food evolved.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. I think the divide between culinary history and food history is sometimes a useful one. I think there are people who really are interested just in what was being cooked, and myself included. Food history, I think, is a lot broader. I think it includes the religious ideas about food, including not eating, and fasting, and also agricultural texts, political texts, documents that are nutritional in origin, agricultural. So in designing this reader, I really tried to put at least one kind of food text in each section from each place. And obviously, I couldn't cover the whole world, and all time from beginning to end. So I kind of plopped down in various periods. So there's, Han Dynasty China, there's the Aztecs, there's medieval Islam, whereas I think it would be too sort of overwhelming if I tried to cover absolutely everything.
Yeah, well, it is overwhelming anyway for somebody just to glance at it. But as you start to read through it, it all makes sense and you see the periods evolving. But tell me a little bit about my question is, how in the world did you, it must have been a lot of editing of choices because impossible to put everything in. But as far as a little quick chronological outline, how far back does the oldest reading date?
Well, I started with the cuneiform texts that are Akkadian, so it's about 1500 BC. They're the oldest recipes, basically, that you could, actually have ingredients and methods that you could call a recipe. There aren't Egyptian ones, funny enough. There are medical texts that from ancient Egypt which look like recipes. They're really not food per se, but that was, I wanted to go as early as possible. There's a lot of readings from ancient Greece and ancient Rome. There's a big section on the Middle Ages. So I thought, to take in as much as I physically could, as would fit in a book. It's about 550 pages, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't actually that hard to compile. I think the sources, if you're doing food history, you kind of know what these sources are, and there's some classic texts you absolutely have to include, and cookbooks, obviously. I tried to put in as many recipes as I could. The really difficult part was actually the permissions. It was getting excerpts from other texts, and sometimes they're very affordable, and publishers are happy to have you reprint a little section of something. And sometimes they were ridiculously expensive, several thousand dollars, which the publisher, just couldn't make money putting things like that in. So in the end, the really hard part, it took about 2 years just to get all the permissions to use these sections. And then some texts, like for China, there's just not a whole lot translated. So getting, what I could, patching it together from various, sometimes old, 19th century sources out of print, didn't always make me it was the best translation, but it was, sometimes I had to sacrifice the newest, loveliest translation for something that we could afford. And a lot of things, interestingly, came from Prospect Books, who really published, I think is the best publisher of historic food texts. So in some cases, I would just, pull a little section from Apicius or pull something from somewhere else that had already been published that would take, your average reader would require, you know, 100 different books, you know, and a fortune to buy all of them. So this one is sort of a digestible form of the whole gamut of primary sources in food history.
Indeed. You were talking about sometimes some of the Chinese, perhaps not the best translations, but I was impressed with the translations of many of the excerpts that you have, because I think you did choose some of the best translations in those excerpts. And as a professor of history, of course, you picked the periods very well to cover.
Yeah, and in some cases, I just translated them myself because I thought, you know, I really wanted some good early modern Spanish recipes in there, so I just did a handful.
Good for
and
you.
I did the Apicius from Latin. So yeah. It was, you know, there were some things that I just really wanted in there, and there was no reason not to just translate them myself.
Absolutely. That's great. And put it in your own vernacular, if you will, you know. But and that's interesting that you did say that you really wanted to, in your words, ultimately what we need is less rehashing of what we already know and new investigation of lesser known texts across many cultures.
Right. Food history is kind of plagued with fake lore, mm-hmm. as our friend Andy Smith calls it. And I think that a lot of the information really is just getting recycled and recycled. And I think we need more, fewer encyclopedias, and I know I'm guilty of that myself, and more original research. And I don't think that's going to happen unless a generation of students is raised on the primary sources and not on the, you know, rehashing of ideas and texts and commentary. I think they just need to read the original stuff. And that's true about any field in history. I think you could say the best place to start is not with a reader or textbook or a, you know, watered-down version or overview, but to read the primary text really means you're engaging with the past directly, and it opens things to interpretation. And I have to say, I'm very excited. I actually started classes yesterday, my food history class, and I'm using this reader for the first time with, it's undergraduate class. And I think it's going to make the class a lot more dynamic, because it won't be just me spoon-feeding them, oh, here is this text of the Banquet of Trimalchio, taken from Petronius, and describing it and saying, there, isn't that interesting? They're reading it for themselves. You know, and can form their own opinions and analyze it. And I think that's much more, you know, for any history course, I think that's ideal.
Right. Well, for our listeners, I'll explain a little bit about the layout, because I have the book sitting in my lap here in front of me, that you just give a snippet of a lot of these primary sources, a lot of these texts, which I think makes the reader hungry to go back to that primary source and read a lot more. But then the interesting thing is that you give them some study questions, some study ideas, some questions about how to read into these. And you even say perhaps to read the introduction to that section after you read the primary source. Tell me why you said that.
Well, I think that's true of any primary source. If you read, even if you're like, pick up a Penguin novel, if you read the introduction, it kind of tells you, here's what you ought to be thinking,
yeah.
and that's what you look for. And I think it's much better to just look at it freshly and have no preformed ideas. And then if you go back to the introduction, these are fairly short excerpts, so you could always look at it again. But I think I really want my readers and want my students to disagree with me. You know, that makes it more interesting if I say, oh, this spice is used here because it's a sign of wealth and social class and blah, 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 whatever. Then they're going to say, oh, yeah, that's right, and not go any further. But if they read it for themselves to start with, they may have a completely different idea, which might be equally legitimate, and then come back and say, he thought it was about class? No, it's about flavor or whatever it may be, you know, that they form their own opinion. So I think that's kind of important for critical thinking, is that when you're reading a text, you're not trying to get the right answer. There is no right answer. You're trying to form an opinion about what it meant to those people, why they were using certain ingredients or cooking methods, or why an exotic ingredient would be used when it's, you know, it doesn't serve any real nutritional purpose. You know,
right.
Cloves taste lovely, but you don't need them in food. Why would people spend so much money to do that? So
right.
it's So I'd like it open to interpretation. And the other thing that I really wanted to include in the whole text just turned out to be far too expensive to do is images, because images are just as good a source for food history. So I've put suggestions all the way through of, look, you know, while you're reading this, look at Bruegel's, Carnival in Lent, or look at an image of aristocratic dining in the Middle Ages, or whenever it may be. So I hope that students will pick up on those little cues I've left all over the place and just go online and find. The images are easy to find.
I thought that was a wonderful suggestion, to pull up a picture and be looking at that as you read the text. I mean, it really does give it another dimension. It was a very interesting suggestion. There is definitely a theme to the reader. I mean, you jump from, as you say, the cuneiform tablets, Trimalchio's feast, Montezuma's banquet, Erasmus's manners. What are the themes of the reader? How would you describe the themes of this reader?
Well, I would say the thing that really ties everything together is that people eat certain things because it's an expression of who they are or who they want to be, and they make conscious decisions, and obviously negotiating among a lot of different choices, at least if they have the wherewithal to purchase, you know, their food and make those choices. But in general, people choose things that will make their lives easier or be an expression of their ethnicity or will help them lose weight or will help them be closer to God or whatever it is. So the theme there is really that this is not really an image of what people were actually eating. I mean, you can't look at a cookbook and say, oh, people were eating this. And you can't look at a text that says, do this and this and you'll grow the best string beans. You don't know if it's prescriptive, right? It's not right. Descriptive. But it does tell you what people's ideas were, what informed their decisions that ultimately did determine what they ate. And that's words. It's the actual text there that are a kind of window into the culture. So you can look at any culture through its art or through its music or through its architecture. And I think food is just one of those things people haven't always really thought that it says much. They think, oh, it's fuel. You know, people eat because they have to be fed and whatever. But it's a lot more complex than that. And people make choices because the food does something for them. It's an idea that either brings them comfort, gives them status, helps them be more righteous, helps, you know. So it's really, it's kind of a compendium of ideas about food and what might have informed people's food choices.
Excellent, yeah. We're going to talk a little bit more about what's actually in some of these texts.
Sure.
Including recipes, when we come back after a short break.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years, so it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Hi, I'm back on The Taste of the Past, and I'm talking with Ken Albala, who's newest, a food historian and professor of history. His newest book is The Food History Reader, Primary Sources. And Ken, you were talking about the themes and obviously critical thinking. So part of the learning objectives coming out of this book, critical thinking being, obviously, you say you want people to understand why they were eating certain foods, right? And what about ingredients? Learning about the actual food history from ingredients. We can learn some of that from these texts, right?
I think so, definitely. I think that's one of the best ways to start food history and introduce people to it is say, where did these ingredients come from? How did they get to where they're used today. And it's something that people are always surprised by. You know, what, you know, chili peppers weren't, and tomatoes weren't in Italy before, you know, really the 18th century, late 17th century when they show up in recipes. So it kind of surprises people to learn the botanical origins of the foods that they eat. And historically, why they're mixed up really is a great introduction to history. What might sound sort of boring, you know, oh gosh, you know, here's the slave trade and here's, well, it's all about sugar, you know. Yeah. So there are very complex stories embedded in where ingredients go and how they're processed and who does the labor and who's buying it and who's consuming it and why. Because, I mean, if, you know, especially when you get to the period of globalization, 17th, 18th century, most of the things that they're trading are completely superfluous. They're not nutritional. They're coffee, tea, sugar, tobacco, spices, and things that, you know, people want and desire, but they're not necessary, and they change the whole world. And I think it's a much better way to learn, you know, here are the themes of globalization, but if you learn it through sugar and tobacco, it's far more enlivened, I think.
Yes, yeah. And I mentioned that we would talk about recipes, but a little note about gastronomic literature. I was surprised. Did anything surprise you that you ended up using that you were surprised about in putting these texts together?
Well, the hardest section, believe it or not, was the modern one, because there was so much I really wanted in there that just cost too much. And fascinating literature that I don't know whether you'd consider it gastronomic per se, but like, for example, I don't know whether it made it in now, I'm thinking about it. I wanted a section from Ray Kroc, who's...
Yes, it did make it in.
Yes. Wonderful. Yes. Okay, I don't remember exactly. I think I wanted Frances Moore Lappé in there. I think I wanted... I wanted something from Silent Spring because it's, you know, there's a section on apples and why they look very bright and shiny. I mean, it was sort of one of those wake-up moments in history where people suddenly said, oh, it might look very nice, but it's got poisons and pesticides in it. So that was the hardest section to really put together. And ultimately, what went in there was kind of odd. James Beard got in there, I think. Craig Claiborne got in there.
Right.
And a selection of Maria Gentile, who I just like her. She's the first Italian-American cookbook, really. And people will probably look at that and say, well, what is this supposed to illustrate? Well, it's immigration, and it's, you know, it's how a food that was completely unknown, foods, cuisine that was unknown, suddenly becomes mainstream. And of course, it's, you know, everyone eats Italian food now. So the themes might not be the new section. You could have done a whole reader just on the 20th century, really. And so the things that actually got in there in the end seem to be sort of not random, but they're odd and interesting. Wilbur Atwater got in there, who was, you know, sort of the man behind our idea of food as fuel and the reductionism of calories and what we call, you know, nutritionism today. Really, really influential, but I don't think he's a household name at all.
No, right. I thought that the beginning and the end were beautiful. I'm starting with the cuneiform tablets, and then ending with the slow food manifesto. I mean, I thought that was pretty brilliant. I mean, sort of taking us, you know, full circle back again to, you know, to what is important about eating.
Exactly the idea. Yeah.
Right.
You know, I always thought that Carlo Petrini wrote it. He didn't. he's the driving force behind the whole movement. But someone else wrote that manifesto, and it looks very much like the Communist Manifesto. I don't know
whether
you know, Americans know the slow food's roots are in the Communist Party.
Yeah, you got me on that too. I got to tell you, I read it, and I said, "Wait a minute, where's Carlo's name?" Right?
Yeah.
Right. Things that surprised me, and that might surprise readers. That are included, because what else was written? But there are sections from the Bible that are in there. There's Beowulf. Let me see what else surprised me. I guess the sections on China and India to me were of course newer, because I think we as a Western culture, we know so little about the beginnings of those cuisines.
Right. And I really put in stuff. I didn't know any of those sources before I started compiling the whole thing. And some of them were so strange and compelling. There's a Yi Li, I guess is how you say it, in the Chinese section. It was about rituals and what a troop of archers should do when they show up at the house of a lord or, you know, landowner. And it's this very strange ritual of facing west and pouring a drink and thanking the host. And it's, you know, remarkably ritualized. So it might not be clear, like, what the themes are. Looking at that, they're in the course as I teach it. There's also a really fascinating horse sacrifice section from the from an ancient Aryan Indian text, which, you know, makes no sense if you think how these people are to become vegetarians as Brahmins. Why do they start off as, you know, sacrificing a horse? So those are they're meant to be shocking and you know, strange. I really wish I could have put a recipe in for every single section. You know, some of these mm-hmm. cultures just don't have cookbooks per se as we think of them. But I think for everywhere I could find, I put in at least five or six recipes, and they courses I'm teaching it in Boston now electronically, we're going to cook them all. So I think they will all, I don't know what they're going to taste like, but they will be, I think, fun. And that's something that I think people miss out when they sit in a, you know, classroom or in their office and just read things and interpret them. And I think you really have to taste the food also to get a sense of what people's aesthetic values were in the past and what excited them. It's sort of like, you know, if you're studying music, you want to hear what it sounds like on period instruments. You want to see the techniques that went into making a Rembrandt painting. And I think it's the same thing with food, is that the action of physically cooking it as close as you possibly can, you know, an original period fuel sources and pots and things. But tasting it, I think, is a way of really kind of apprehending the past in the same way that you would, you know, go to an exotic restaurant and say, oh, here's this Thai food, and now I sort of get a sense of this culture from the way things taste. Well, the past is another great place to travel in that respect, you know, and I think that a lot of these flavors, they sound sort of weird when you put them together, but they really, really work. To give you an example, out of the Apicius text, there's one recipe that includes, that it's pork. It's based, you know, like on the pork shoulder is what I usually use. And it includes apricots and vinegar and honey and fish sauce, what they, garum, which mm-hmm. was sort of their source of salt on everything. And a whole slew of flavors, which we would think might not go together. But when you put them all together, it tastes like a really good sort of barbecue-y sauce. You know, it's sweet and sour and salty and spicy. There's pepper in it, too, at the same time. So that you really can't appreciate those things unless you actually taste them. So there's a lot of recipes in there. And obviously, you can, you know, use the recipes and interpret them in other ways. But I would encourage people to actually cook from it as well.
Absolutely. I mean, there are, I and a group of us through the Culinary Historians have attempted always to cook from old texts or whatever program we're presenting. And once you get past, of course, the lack of amounts and specific directions, I mean, you can really cook these recipes, and they are, you know, despite what some people might think that it was, you know, cruder times without sophisticated cooking, wrong. Absolutely wrong.
Exactly.
These are all very sophisticated dishes. And
yeah, and I find
delicious.
When people, you know, make a recipe from the past and it doesn't taste good, they've usually fudged it. Mm-hmm. They've done something and they said, oh, that won't taste good, so I'll throw in this instead. Or I'll do this and ignore the instructions. And I have to say, when I follow old recipes and I don't veer from the instructions, it always works. Or if something goes wrong, it's because I haven't understood the directions and looked at them carefully enough. But really, you know, people would not write down a recipe if it didn't work. I think
right.
That's, you know,
yeah, I think
just a rule in food history.
Yeah, I think we might learn something from these old texts too and start adopting some of their instructions. I think the instructions are more a story from these rather than now we have, you know, the dump and stir thing, 1, 2, 3, 4, and,
yeah.
You know, you're done. And even the measurements. The one thing I saw, and I'm trying to remember now where did I see it? It was on put in an onion about the size of four fingers. Well, now, how how wonderfully descriptive is that?
Right? Yeah.
A medium onion or a large onion? Well, it depends what market you shopped at, you know.
That's right. And my favorite is the cooking time. Sometimes they will say, cook this for two paternosters.
Okay.
A paternoster is exactly 30 seconds. If you say it out in Latin, two paternosters is 1 minute. So you're searing something for a minute. And I think, you know, the other thing, it was funny you mentioned this, that there are techniques and combinations of food that we could actually use today. There's, for example, a technique in the Middle Ages which seems really counterintuitive, but to roast something, food is often parboiled. In other words, they'll put it in boiling water, take it out, and you think, oh no, you're losing all the flavor, whatever. But it actually firms the meat up, and so it will fit on a spit without falling off, and it prevents the fat from just sort of dripping and falling into the fire. It doesn't sound like it would work because it's completely unmodern technique, but it does actually really nicely.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I was even amazed, even things like eggplants, you know, the parboil, they would plop the whole thing in boiling water. So many things they would parboil.
Yeah, it's a pretty standard technique. And combinations and flavors that I think, you know, there are a handful of chefs who are trying to revive old flavors, or they at least pretend that they are.
Mm-hmm.
I won't name any names, but there's a golden apple, which a chef in London made out of the form of curry, which is a medieval cookbook, and he basically just did whatever he wanted and called it that. And I thought, why did you miss a great opportunity to? Because the original recipe is great; it's fantastic. It's a fake apple made out of pork that's ground up into a meatball and then gilded, so it looks like this golden apple. But like, why not do it as it was originally? Because then I don't see the point in faking it. I guess that's what I mean. But,
or create your own thing and don't adopt another name, a previous name. You know, create something brand new.
Yeah. Or don't claim that this is a historic recipe and this is what they were eating. Invent something new and call it something new.
This is, to me, is a delight, and I plan to share it with so many people, including my readers who ask questions. It puts it all in one place, and then, you know, you give a wonderful bibliography, and when you like a section of something that perhaps you weren't introduced to before, I think it opens the door for readers to go and research that source and get more and read it. And I thank you so much for putting it all under one cover. It's really not all that big. It's a very manageable book, and it's something that is not at all intimidating to people who might think, oh my God, I'll never get through all these texts. It's a very good read, I would say.
Thank you.
Oh, that's me. And, you know, it offers instructive ways to think about our food and our food systems and, indeed, how they've been shaped by historical forces. Ken Albala, I thank you so much for sharing your time, and I look forward to more things coming from you. And I know you jump into all kinds of fields, and it's always interesting to see what you're going to come up with next.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And thanks for listening. This, again, has been A Taste of the Past, and I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.